passage in Exodus, was it 4:24, and it says, "And it came to pass, by the way, in the end, that the Lord," large letters, "met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said, 'Surely, if thy husband art thou to me.'" Now, what was that all about? Was it because the child wasn't circumcised? And
so it was a violation of covenant law, but the translation is suffered its violence. In other words, the Lord intercepted him and stood before him is the proper translation. But because it demonstrates vehemence, great force, and determination, it's translated there because this is also used if one was to strike a blow or to give a deadly cleft, and so it's translated the Lord stood before him killing. If the Lord wanted to kill Moses, he wouldn't even have to bother to wave his little finger, you know that. So what God did is withstood him to force him to fulfill the instructions of the covenant.
That's right.
Yeah. This was because slighting towards this was not something that couldn't be spared. In other words, Moses, to assume the responsibility of leadership and to carry out the leadership which he had to carry through in detail. However, he'd get bogged up with so many things that sometimes he bypassed detail, and so this he was called to do. There's more on this in the Zohar. It's quite explanatory. The old Zohar was everything that was ever said by God to leading patriarchs. In other words, like you've seen a New Testament that had all the words that Jesus spoke in red. Well, the Zohar has all the things that God ever said to man, whether it was in these Old Testament volumes or many, many more that we don't have bound in. So practically, the old Zohar had everything from the books of Seth, the books of Enoch, and the books of the Bees, all the things that were said by God to man in earth were in the Zohar. Now, there's a lot of things Enoch was told in the heavens, and Paul was told in the heavens, and so forth. Well, of course, Paul was afterwards, but it wouldn't have been in there. But the things that God said to Enoch in the earth was in there. And, of course, things that Enoch said in the earth that God had said would be in there.
So that's called Zohar?
Yeah, that's called Zohar. It's really hard to...
Z-O-H-A-R.
Now, this also can be contaminated by Jewish perversion, just as they sought to adjust the Septuagint and so forth, we see. But and you can get a Zohar if you went to a bookstore where the Jews had their volumes and asked for a Zohar, you come up with a Jew one. And then you can get a Zohar if you wanted to get an early translation of the Greek version of the Zohar, you'd come up with the Zohar before it was contaminated in the after years when the Jews penetrated theology and wanted to shift this over. See, then you'd get what we call the Alexandrian version. And this like the Alexandrian version or text of Old Testament, as well as New, is much more reliable. I had a copy stolen out of here a year ago when I went to Idaho. And
mine was
one of the originals, 1872. I mean, 1872 was the last printing of the complete one. However, I understand that there's a Zohar that's being printed in Europe today, and there's one that was that is very accurate. It's now available. I still have one.
Where did you get that?
Well, I would go to a half a dozen book hunters and tell them to try to find me an old one, or don't even say old, just find me a Zohar that wasn't printed by a Jewish press. Just tell them this, say. Because then, if you tell them you want an old one, they come up with five different prices on it, they find it. If you just tell them you want a Zohar, you may get it more reasonable, see. Because I have a lot of experience with book hunters.
If it's printed before 1872, it'd be probably all right.
Well, yes, and it could be printed since then, but the only one that I've seen that was reliable of the late old printings was 1872.
That whole combination of books like the Bible?
No, the Zohar isn't a book. The Zohar is the sum total of the revelations of the things God told man and earth. And then there might be even, to some degree, there may be things that related to this in happening or event that they discuss, and it's there. And so the Zohar is added to through the years as it goes along. And all of a sudden the Zohar cut off. And the Zohar cut off before the minor prophets. They cut off at about the last of the Zohar's ends with Elisha. So there is, well, it goes a little farther than that because the Zohar goes up to Ezekiel, because it does say what God told Ezekiel. Well, it's compiled by your race, just traditional record added and added to. It was the things spoken, these were the spoken declarations. Any other question?
Would you like to comment on this?
Well, I don't know what it needs much comment on right now. The first place, of course, it followed a 4-degree alignment, and it was building up. And the alignments that preceded it some 40 days ago when we had the major alignments in the sky, and those alignments, of course, triggered the St. George Island disasters. Remember at that time we said if St. George Island or Martinique had these disasters, that within 40 days there'd be waves in the west coast, there'd be tidal waves and subterranean patterns, and that the earthquake alignments for the end of March, which we gave in our January preview, the last week of March, was alignments we said would largely affect Alaska or in the Aleutian Island areas, but could be anywhere from the Andes to the Aleutian Islands. Well, so what you got? You got it on time, see. Now, let's remember that this is judgment. Let's remember that the Jews have had too much to do with Alaska. And remember, this is where they were going to put their mental health deal, and they already had it started. And if you looked at last Sunday, the place where the government had this great big mental health hospital started, and all these buildings, and they're all flat as a pancake.
They are? Yeah. Well, that's good.
Now, another thing that's interesting about this...
Then they can't put me there right away.
No, they can't put any of us right there unless they leave us out in the cold. So. There's some other factors involved around this. Probably there was no place that had a higher immorality standard inside the United States than Alaska, because whereas you might think of the old cribs of Las Vegas and so forth, this was true in Anchorage and in all these major cities. The Jews were running this. They imported all kinds of girls from Seattle and brought them up there. Plus, they were running the thing wide open, and it was so much a detriment that they were afraid it was going to bar them from statehood, and their motto was clean up Alaska before statehood. But they didn't clean it up very much, and as soon as they got statehood, they went back into business. And so it was it not only was a hodgepodge of corruption and immorality, but the Jews pretty well dominated and controlled most of the businesses. They averaged 250% higher costs on all kinds of commodities, though the shipping price from Seattle of almost all of these goods was less than 4% of the cost of the goods by bulk. So you see, 250% profit for a 4% shipping is strictly a Jew operation, see. So outside of the fact that there were a lot of fishermen that lost ships, and of course it's a terrible catastrophe, there's a lot of good people there and so forth, at the same time it was a mess, and it's the kind of judgment that falls. And so here again, it may have more significance than we realize, but the fact is it is on alignments, and it did hit according to scale. We know that it wiped out almost all the shipping in Alaska and Kodiak and all of those spots. Of course, you've seen the reports and the view of what transpired. You'll note that you'll note something else about it, rather callously. You read the eyewitness accounts, and there's only about two of them that trade. You ever notice that? I noticed this for 5 days of newspaper clippings and accounts. Everything upset and collapsed and folded up, and only a couple people mentioned the fact that they started to pray as this thing hit. Say, well, the one fellow on the air cried, "My God, what's transpiring?" Say, and he says cars are bouncing around like 10 pins, and the next minute his car was bouncing around, and that was the first message out that was being picked up by a man in the New England states on a short wave, because all the stations went dead, everything went dead. This is not over. It's not just aftershocks. There'll be more fault movement, and it'll gear into future dates. The alignment pattern in April will be able to kick off some more tremors. It's expanding on its cycle now. They had an earthquake yesterday in Japan, and one in New Hampshire. See, so you get your cycles as it moves, as the Earth moves and rotates. It'll print off now and start to vary. It'll kick off about 8 degrees a day from here on out. Another question?
Yes,
Well, April is your next major set of alignments. Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about California?
Well, we ride on
California.
So, California, of course, the San Andreas Fault runs through California, and this, of course, is the biggest earthquake maker in the world, say, to a degree. It starts way down in the Gulf of Mexico, and it comes right on through, goes through Cajon Pass, comes up through, it cuts into the Gulf of California, ties into faults that go clean down both sides of the Mexican Peninsula. One of them goes down the other side of San Diego out to sea, cuts on across and moves it through the Riverside Fault and the Englewood Fault, the Long Beach Fault. All these are small fissure faults off of the San Andreas Fault. However, because of the way the country down there is cut up with the ocean coming way deep inland, the ocean comes in some places all the way to the Sierra Madre Mountains with high ribs of granite and sandstone. Some places there's 2,500 and 2,600 foot of shelf material, and underneath this is seawater. And in that shelf material can be freshwater springs and everything else coming down out of the mountains, and still underneath it is salt water. And if you drill on through it, you'll hit salt water and ruin the springs that are above it, even the water tables. This is what's happened when they drilled for oil and hit through some of these hollow pockets. Some of the deepest parts of the Pacific Ocean lie between on our west coast, between Northern California and Mexico. In Monterey Bay, why we have one of the deepest parts of the ocean, submarines can go underneath the land, almost back as far as San Juan Capistrano there. They were talking about making a great submarine base out of this during the war because of the vast depths of water under that shelf. In other words, Monterey, Fort Ord, Seaside, Watsonville, well, they're just sitting on nothing, see, as the little ribs holding it up here and there. But I know this is going under one of these days. See, I can tell you more about that sometime, but I know Watsonville is a goner. As far as when you get up to Capitola, she gets solid, and from there all the way over to the Santa Cruz Mountains, and hitting south in the Santa Cruz Mountains, 28 miles south is Holy City, and then right straight on up through Felton is solid all the way up to San Francisco. The shelf ends there. Now there's a little shelf north of Santa Cruz, but it isn't very much. There is some shelf materials, some shelf spots, very small ones, north of San Francisco. And then when you get up towards Eureka, well, there's no more shelf because the fault is running right along the coast, right out there under the ocean, right along this sea. Runs on up past Trinidad, on up to, and shears off about at Crescent City. In the meantime, the major San Andreas Fault has taken off at Stimson Beach and heads for Japan. It's just straight line, say. The parallel fault, which runs out to sea as much sometimes as 200 miles, but comes inland according to contour, runs from the Aleutian Islands south to the Andes. And it ties in with a fault that comes in about 140 miles south of the border in Mexico, runs down the coast of Mexico, and then cuts inland and goes under Central America, and comes right through the Andes. The Andes uplift is almost a southern continuation of the High Sierra uplift. Only thing is that the High Sierra is not as old as the Andes, is just about 1,000 to 2,000 years older, depending on the part. The Alabama Hills, which is this little row, funny eroded mountain that's up here to the east of the High Sierras, is the oldest mountain in the United States. This Alabama Hills starts in south of Lone Pine and runs along behind Lone Pine and then disappears just before you get to Manzanar. Well, those mountains are called the Alabama Hills. These are Precambrian, so you see these are over 1.5 million years old and were once a mountain chain as high as the Sierras. And the White Mountains is older than the Sierras, and in the southern part, there's one little bit of this Precambrian material, and this is on the south slope of the White Mountains, on the north side of Westgard Pass. This is 1.5 million year old stuff too, but the other part of the White Mountains is much later, and pushed up on both sides of this, leaving this peculiar boulder pile that exists in there off of Wyman Creek. This formation is very old. Now, the reason we mention this is because when the High Sierras went up, It went up about the same time that the continent went down, or the last of it subsided. And in this subsidence, the High Sierras is very young. And after it had every little while there'd be eruptions, volcanic eruptions caused by its uplift. And things remain relatively still until about 400 or 500 years ago, 600 at the latest. And at that time, volcanoes broke out at near Big Pine, and a volcano broke out just above Little Lake. And there used to be a river that came down Owens Valley and split and went off where China Lake is, and went through what was then a depression over near Randsburg, and came down near San Bernardino and through Cajon Pass, and it dumped into what we now call Salton Sea Country. Well, when this volcano erupted, it shifted the ground, and it blocked that off and dammed it up, and it formed what was one time a lake that extended all the way up Owens Valley, almost to Bishop. And the Indians remember in the traditions of the last 10 generations, they remember this, how there used to be this long river and how it was turned into a lake by the how this great scarp that you see when you drive up Owens Valley, that you see there by Little Lake and just south of it, that this wall was made by the lava coming down to where the river was, and when it hit the water, well, it solidified and went straight up, say. So that's why it piled up there, because when it backed up the water, it backed it up first on the south end of it, and then this formed this lake of water by this lava, and as this new lava came down from that peak and hit this water, it just chilled right off, say. And the Indians tell, and in the history of Yin-Yo and other volumes I have on this, the Indians talk about the tradition of how the devils made the great smokes, and the great white steam rolled to the sky and made clouds, and the clouds for about 40 years, where the great clouds rolled to the sky, which was nothing but steam that came from the Owens Valley material, say. Well, now that last uplift finally went, so it was only the solidification of this chain of volcanoes was as recent as 1911 or 12, when Mount Lassen, of course, made its explosion, and the weight of the gas, you know, just sheared off trees like they were tenpins up there. Of course, that's been the last basic active volcano in California. There is two that could blow at any time, and it may be a little silent, but one of them is down near Calpatria, right in the middle of the Salton Sea, and this, or just on the end of Salton Sea, and in those low hills out there, volcanic hills. I have listened to them growl and rumble 1931 and 2. I was camped there during duck season for every 3 or 4 days, and I listened to them growl and rumble and quiver a little bit every once in a while, and then sulfur would come up out of them, see. Well, I later got some seismic record on this, and this growl and rumble is not hot springs alone, though there is hot springs. This is volcanic. So there is the only rumbler that we had in California for some time. Now there's been rumbles farther north, but this is the last of the rumblers. You go down to Mexico. Now this has almost stopped rumbling, but the fault lines have been increasing in pressure. This whole Cajon fault, or the San Andreas fault, has been picking up pressure now for about 14 years, picking up intensely. And but it had nothing to do with the earthquake that broke in Tehachapi about 10 years ago. That quake was the Bear Mountain fault, but it could have been built up by where this fault cuts across the Taft. We have what's called the Garlock Fault. The Garlock Fault comes along south of Tehachapi and turns and goes up just west of Mojave and goes right up along that mountain all the way on up until it gets almost to Cantel, and then cuts off of the El Paso Range towards Randsburg and stops at the old spot called Garlock. That's why it's called the Garlock Fault. That's the northern terminal end of that fault. Another fault comes down Owens Valley, right down through Owens Valley next to the mountain, and goes right through the middle of the town of Lone Pine. Its street is right in the middle of it. In fact, I think it was 1878 or 1887 that they had their last major quake there, and the street opened up and swallowed horses, carriages, and everything else. In fact, it came together, leaving just the tail of one horse like this, where a horse and stagecoach had gone down. It killed, I think, about 127 people in Lone Pine. Big old adobe buildings collapsed and so forth. But they rebuilt the town in the exact same spot. Even though the street opened up and closed there, they rebuilt in the same spot. And so, of course, these buildings now are not as likely to fall apart as those Dobies did, because you can beat up a lot of wooden buildings. When Tehachapi went, why all the Dobies cracked, and the old buildings that were not wood, and almost most of the damage there was to beer halls and hotels and all the joints. They took the worst beating. Of course, other things took a beating, Tehachapi. But I knew this was coming. We announced it to the congregations in Los Angeles on Sunday night. It'd be a major earthquake before morning. And the alignments were right. And then we got an intuitive flash. The Lord told us it'd be a big earthquake. And we just needed this anyhow. So we told the people that it would shake before morning. And then we came on home. And we knew it was going to shake. I had camera equipment and everything ready. And I went to sleep and woke up about 4:30 and the sky was changing colors to green and yellow. And this is what it was doing outside in Antelope Valley. It was just as though sulfur fumes were in the air. All the dogs and all the cattle were starting to make a great noise. And before the earthquake came, this terrible noise of all the livestock in the valley, like they were shouting through a megaphone. And every dogs, our birds were making a big fuss, and then she came. And so before that first tremor was out of the way, we had the shortwave radio on. We knew where it was. So I got up there, midst of those tremors, and I photographed that. And I have about 35 color slides of that, with people laying in the streets and people running around in their night clothes and the buildings falling down and everything else. I got those pictures there of that quake. Now, this is a Garlock quake. Now, this is a tectonic quake. Most quakes we get are rolling quakes in California. They crack your plaster, make a terrible noise, but they're not tectonic. Now, in Tehachapi itself, it rolled and slid, but down in Bear Mountain, which is the major mountain that goes down on the left side of the Tehachapi Mountains and is to the south of Arvin, where this and a fault tees off of that and goes into Bakersfield, cuts over and hits the Taft main San Andreas fault. Here the earth opened up 8, 10, 11, 12 feet in width. In fact, it stayed wide open there. Here, after the thing quit trembles, as much as 2 months after that, some geologists were so curious that they lowered them down on oil well cable in a bosun's chair, and they lowered them down for about 3,500 feet. There's over a mile of cleft there, and maybe more, that goes down into the earth. It's still standing wide open up there. So you can see that when that Bear Mountain fault moved, though 12 miles away they got tremors, but on the other side of what we call fill faults, they didn't get it. Now, actually, at one time, when before the High Sierras moved and the coast range tilted at the time that the Lemurian continent went down, there used to be a great the south end of what we San Joaquin Valley, and in fact more than the south end, all the way to Fresno, was sea. And before that land went up, that's why in those hills to the south as well as to the east, you go over there and get hundreds of shark teeth, all kinds of fossil bones. The amount of sea life in the ocean then, and the amount of sharks that used to be along here were tremendous. I've got some of them there, great big shark teeth. You can go out there with a sieve and get petrified shark teeth by the hundreds. And the bones of large fish in that were laid in there positively prove that's where the ocean bay was. When Lemuria was a major continent, there were dividing seas. In other words, they weren't 1,000 miles across, but they were several hundred miles across. And the continent had many huge inlets and bays that went in. One of them was over 700 miles in the northern parts. They can tell that by ocean topography today. And they had subterranean oceans. Well, this makes for subsidence. If a continent goes down under great shaking, splitting in earthquakes, then it subsides. Actually, what subsided was on stilts, so to speak, here and there, with these great fissures, just like our coastal plain. Lemuria is beginning to come up some. Atlantis is coming up now. This is why the activity east of the Azores, and now they have had to put new buoys and markers for the shipping lanes, because there's areas too shallow now where formerly there was no problem at low tides, where you've got the low tide plus the uplifts that have taken place from volcanic action and earthquake. It makes it dangerous sometimes for shipping that's bringing a long time, so they got new boys. Oh, she's coming back, yes. And so a chain of action can produce this. And it can come up, people think in terms of an inch every 20 years or something like that, but this can happen 100 foot in 10 minutes too, see. So this is being watched by geologists everywhere. The historical geologist pays more attention to this. But this is why these new buoys and new markers that they've had to put out east of the Azores. So there's no question about the fact that there are many areas like this. Now, actually, in Colorado, and across, running from Colorado north towards Montana and through Idaho, is a huge earthquake fault. This fault ends up in Yellowstone, say. Now this.
Does that go anywhere near Denver? Or?
Well, Denver, it passes between Denver and Golden, Colorado.
Golden.
Between there, that's right. Now, then this fault goes towards the east. Now, they can. That's right. Now this fault, one of these faults is west of Grand Junction. See, moves west of Grand. Yeah, right. It's east of Grand Junction, and east of the Umpqua Large Forest, and it turns and goes through the mass of the Rockies. Well, now that's the reason. This has been inactive for years, but she's starting to kick a little, say. And there's another one that went down, a major fault that extended with a mountain range. This mountain range reached from the Great Lakes all the way down through Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and all the way south to Mexico. So. Well, now this mountain went down at the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition. Just before they came that far west, this had gone down. And they've talked in Lewis and Clark, if you go back to the old writings, and I have the old narratives of Lewis and Clark expedition, talks about the terrible earthquake they felt when they were crossing the continent, see, and how trees were knocked flat, and they found flat trees all over, how the Indians told them that a whole mountain chain had disappeared within, and it had happened in several stages, the Great Quiver, and then they said that the devils were angry, and that the White Spirit was angry and had not protected them, and the mountains were being swallowed up, and this was, they thought, a forerunner of terrible things, and of course the white man was a terrible thing, they thought, because it's a forerunner. But, and the Narragansetts, which are a white tribe, and with King Philip, remember the Narragansetts, a white man, Pocahontas was too. Well, these Narragansetts were Israelites of the household of the Scandinavians that had come over and settled around the Great Lakes, forced into tribal existence by the attack from Asiatic Indians, and of course, they had Indians that, now the Mohawks, the Delawares, the Mohicans, the Senecas, these were white Indians. They weren't Indians at all. They were white men, Scandinavians. In fact, they found a lot of their Viking ships preserved in the water where they sunk them with stones to return next year, bring them up, and then they never were able to do that. The siege around their villages and the superstition in which Indians not fighting at night withdrew from their area of their siege, and they went tribal, moving out of their cities at night, and this is the story, a long story of the history of that. You'll find that quite a lot has been done in the last 18 years on the historical archaeology of various Indians and white Indians, and they've proven that the Indians of that area were not Indians but were Scandinavians. Both the iron axes and their forges and all of these things that relate to that, though they gradually slipped from it through time. This is why we had this white affinity. So also were the Iroquois, say.
That where the Mormons get the idea. They claim it's one of the lost tribes.
Well, the Mormons talk about Indians being of the 10 tribes, but they're not all Indians. They got this out of this narrative, of course, part of which is inspired. Part of which is Hui, but the thing is that they were very accurate on Maya in South America, Central America, which they couldn't have done without some guidance. Surely no young person in Upper State New York or even any Christian church preacher would have known any of these things. See, so this is there was some area of inspiration, but Mormonism has greatly deteriorated today, just like the Methodists and the Baptists have. And of course, they had some areas of fantasy, which I think that this preacher had some rainstorms, and when he helped to this translation and all, I don't think Moroni got in on all of it, see. I think there's positively error here in some of it. But there's still a lot of truth there, and of course, this is significant. But these Indian records also tie in there with their ancient tradition. They tell about the sinking of the continent on the west. And Mayan tradition tells about the land going under to the east, and they were waiting for the day of the coming of the gods. And so this is why, and when Manasseh crossed the river, or crossed the great waters in 700 BC, 710, that was part of Manasseh, that didn't go out with the captivity, on the ships of Dan, which were Phoenician ships, she came to the Caribbean Sea, that was Manasseh did. And they brought knowledge to the Mayans, who already had an ancient Tulapec, and it was, well, the ancient Mayan pre-Incan civilization was tied into ancient Lemuria and Asiatic theology. Well, along comes the white man, and they accepted him as the gods. And they told them all about the tradition of our race. That's why they know everything, Noah, right on down. And so this is why Mayan history and writing contains all Old Testament record of all kinds of things which they had from word to mouth by tradition by the white gods that visited them. And this is, of course, where the great strains came that produced the white Apache, the white Cherokee, the white Aztecs, and the Tulapec. And this is why they, as they added to their pyramid temples and to their formation, those are all inside temples, you see, and they're not just tombs. And along with this, you'll find incorporated into Mayan Quechi legend all these biblical factors. And that's why when Cortez arrived, they thought this was the return of the white gods, and Cortez just could walk right on through all the way to the Inca Sea, which he did. Of course, he might have been cruel, but he did have a point or two. It was accept the true God or else, see. And it did have its points in some ways. They didn't absorb him. Any other questions? Of course, I didn't answer you.
That's all right. That's the way that you were supposed to do anyway, probably.
I didn't answer you. Because the exact time of this pattern of alignment is measured by other things. I think that, in other words, I think there's going to be earth disasters or quakes in other parts of the country that'll be more severe maybe than this. Though what'll make a great catastrophe out of the first major chopper we get in the LA district will be so many of those towns all the way to the seacoast are on ridges, see. And when they get a chopper quake instead of a roller, which they'll get, because there's a 27-foot movement cocked in this fault right now, when they get a chopper quake, a whole lot of areas of that is going to be seawater. Everything's going to drop. So I wouldn't... You couldn't give me the other side of that mountain. See.
So this
is
going to be Imperial Valley?
No, Imperial Valley... Imperial Valley isn't going anywhere. It's where it used to be. But it,
right there.
Yeah, it always was right there like that. So this is not, this is far enough inland it won't be bothered by this. Now there's areas that are not going to go down.
Yeah,
there's
this place here won't be bothered.
It's not likely to be bothered very much because where it's located. That's why I live here. If I thought that this was going to go, I wouldn't stay here, you know. Anything the other side of that fault can be bothered, but not so much between the fault and the Sierra Madres as the table on the other side. Even though the other side of the mountain always shakes more than this does. Well, you say, why? Because it's rough on both sides. But the other side shakes more than this does. And the mountains, oh, this whole mountain chain over here can catch tremors, this whole Sierra Madres. But she's solid granite, see? And she sits only on two limestone plates and it goes into Miocene and then Precambrian. So you've got great antiquity of solid formation under it. But that shelf on the other side vibrates just like a sheet of steel because its strength is tied into this mountain. And only the ribs that come down from what were major ribs from this mountain support that. So it's just like great arches. Well, there's areas where maybe there'll be 15 miles of solid granite ridge. Well, that's all right. You could live on that forever. But in between that, she can go. And the cross fissures could crack it and lay her sideways, just like she did in the Teton Peninsula. Well, there's faults all over the earth, but major faults, which we call cataract chasm faults, there's one of them that goes up right under Las Vegas and up to the left side of the dam and goes right within about a mile of that atom bomb testing site and heads for Nevada and it breaks off and turns towards, it turns this side of Zion and the fault fissures and goes almost to the west portal of the Grand Canyon. Oh no, no, that's another part. Yeah, but the thing is about the, you know, you guys think here, you got in the mountains Winnemucca. There's a fault at Winnemucca. See, it isn't too big. It's not a tectonic fault, but there is a fault at Winnemucca that comes southward. If there hadn't been any fault there, there wouldn't have been any gold in those mountains either. And it's the fissure faults that are west of Elko that make that country. But those are big faults, and they don't tie into a big fault. But one of these days, Babylon will get it on all sides. You see, this valley is on a cushion. You've got sand, water, and sandstone and granite and sand, and then you go through that sands, and then you got an oil cushion. And they'll have to drive 6,000 feet for it. Is there another question on this or anything else?
How much sandy valley?
Well, it's got a feather fault in it. It's not as part of bedrock either. You don't have as big a cushion on it, but it moves when the San Andreas Fault moves. I mean, it doesn't. It's not tectonic. It's not going to open up and swallow up like some things. In other words, but if the only thing can happen there, and this is. And that is that the high that you know this is it, when you go towards the ocean, it gets that the land rises before it drops, and that one time the water came through there, way deep inland, and this was kind of a little inland sea, but that was many years ago, and the subsidence and the upwhips came together. If ever that upwhip dropped in there on the old channel, well then you could get a certain amount of seawater in there, but it isn't going to split open. It might drown you, but it'd never crush you. It's not likely to subside. It's more likely to come up above it, because we're not in a subsidence area. Up in the north, subsidence is what's going to happen to some degree in maybe northwestern Canada. This is going to be true possibly in those areas of the Wootons. And as the land masses rise south, they're as liable to be as dropping there.
I may ask a question. Maybe I'm mistaken on this, but I thought I heard you say on the prophecy for the year, you know, mm-hmm. on New Year, Christmas time or New Year's, yes. For this coming year, that
yes.
There might be, now I may be mistaken on it, but you correct me if I am, that during the time of the next president, this is far afield from earthquake, of course, but I thought you said, assuming that Johnson was elected and was in office, it would be about the second or third year around in there, whoever was president, there'd be some kind of a catastrophe. I don't know what that meant. Do you mean that'd be another assassination or?
Well, I don't think he's got that long. I don't think he's got that long.
You think he isn't going to be elected?
Well, I'm not going to speculate at this moment on whether he'll be elected or whether he'll make it that long, whether he'll stand the strain of the campaign, or whether there'll be those that'll help him not stand it. The Irish mafia that he has around him would never be depended upon. In my estimation, I personally believe that tied right in with this bunch of scallywags around him, and the Ogpu of the Soviet Union and the CIA's defectors who they're trying to cover up for, I think are a part of those who were in on the assassination. This is my personal belief.
They'll probably do away with him.
I think that they'll do away with anybody in their way, mm-hmm. until America cleans it up.
Listen, I heard the other night that Robert Kennedy was going to run for president.
I understand that there's talk in the Democratic Party now that, and this is almost unheard of, that an incumbent president might not be the nominee. But I hear that there's talk enough now. Now, actually, it's rather interesting with what the pressure they put on this Baker case. Now, this Baker case is Johnson's baby. And it's as crooked as a dog's hind leg. There isn't any question about the fact that they covered up for super graft, shaped down con artists, and everything else, say. And so
the Republicans are making big chaos.
Yes, but some of the Republicans didn't want to get involved for reasons of their own. But the fact still remains that if they wanted to make big hay, they should make hay out of this Baker case. They should make hay also out of the State Department providing all these prostitutes and violating their own Mann Act by sending them all over the states with Sukarno, and this makes them procurers and puts them into violation of the Mann Act and proves that they are depraved and immoral and everything else. See? Now they can say this has been going on forever, but you can prove this.
There's 800 of them, you know.
Well, of course, we have had no president in the United States that's even fit for citizenship since Roosevelt took over. Just remember that.
That's true.
Right. Of course, we might let Truman stand as maybe saying he qualifies for citizenship, but he's not smart. He ran with gangsters before. At best, he was a gangster's henchman while he was in there. And he did have more Native Americanism about him from time to time, but at the same time, he wasn't presidential timber. He wasn't smart enough to be a congressman. In fact, dog catcher was as far as he should ever make.
He couldn't make a success of the necktie.
Oh, well, I mean, how could any man make a success in business with a Jew? That's right. The Jew is bankrupting. I will say this. For all the phoniness for the outfit he worked for, he had a certain amount of stable honesty. For even though he went bankrupt and the Jew beat his, Harry Truman, through the years, paid off every cent of that bankruptcy, paid it off out of his own money, and was still paying it off out of presidential salary. So, in other words, this one thing he did do, his own personal debts, he paid it off.
Thank you. I'm not going to feel so bad when you accuse me of looking like Harry Truman.
He's the only. That's the only thing that I can say that he did do. He had a personal integrity about his own debts, but as far as anything else, he had no integrity about what he did with our money. That's right.
Well, I'll say this: I told Irene coming up today that since Harry Truman left office, we've had practically no service at all in the post office department.
Well, no,
when
because
Truman was president, I'll say this for Harry, we had good delivery of mail. At
now,
that time.
Truman kept the niggers out.
At that time, we didn't have all the postmen were Negro people.
Now, this fellow's from Missouri, remember this now, and Kansas.
Yeah.
So he kept the niggers out.
I know.
It wasn't, the niggers didn't pour in great numbers until after Truman. However, since that time, this is what's our trouble with mail everywhere, say.
Yeah, well, don't you feel the same thing? Truman had two deliveries a day, you didn't lose your...
Well, I'll tell you, this isn't his brains. This is that during his time, there was two things he wouldn't let. He wouldn't let the nigger pressure affect the operation of government, so the post office master could run it to suit himself, see. But, I mean, it wasn't because it wasn't necessarily... great brilliance in engineering on his part. It was just if you know Kansas and Missouri, I mean, they've never been as states that let the niggers kick them around too much, you know, say. I mean, they know a little score about this. So, he was a Pendergast. Right. Well, this is what's the trouble with the mail now, say. All over the United States. Question?
Was Sargon the
king? Sargon Magnificent was the name given by the Akkads to Cain.
It wasn't Cain.
Cain, yes, this was the name given to Cain. Cain's name, the Akkads called Cain Sargon. This is, and he was known in history as Sargon, the city of Cain and all the things that he built up. This is Sargon. More than that, we've got the whole history of his sons and of the emperors of his line and so forth, and probably one of the finest pieces of work that was done on that was from one of the curators of the British Museum, and this is Bristow. She wrote Sargon the Magnificent, the oldest letters in the world, Cain and argument, these blocks, this was, you don't have it. Well, you do that. Well, I have most of these in my library. I have all these in my library more, but I have a question.
Can you start calling out the sounds of running in California, and this is illegal too? How can you do this?
No, it's not illegal. There's strangely enough,
it ought to be,
but it's not. In other words, you wanted to run for senator in New York State, you could do this if you got the filing money, and you put up the money on the Senate. You see, this can be done. Now, one time, senators were not elected. Senators were selected by the legislators. But when they amended this so that senators would be elected, they didn't qualify the fact that the senator had to be a resident of a given period of time within that state in continuity. And they didn't spell out the qualifications for one filing for the Senate. And so anyone can file for the Senate anywhere if they got the money. That's true with Congress too. However, there are requirements for congressmen now as they can register, but you can't register as a congressman in a state that you don't live in unless you are a resident of Washington, D.C. and in government employ. But the Senate, you see, in other words, a person in government employ that is in Washington, D.C. could have been born in Ohio, but he could claim any state as his state while he's in government employ, and therefore he could file for Congress if he has the filing fees. So they could, because of the, well, this has got a lot of ramifications.
No.
However, certain state laws can govern congressional state laws can govern congressional elections. Some states we make have a specific spelled out requirement that you must reside in the congressional district that you run for at the time that you file. But other states don't have this. Well, I'll tell you what it is. The Washington Irish Mafia is running against the California Mafia. In other words, remember that as far as Brown, Mock, and the Jews out here are concerned, they've got their gang, and this Salinger Kennedy gang, Schlesinger gang, they use this bunch for an election, but they don't always play one another's political game. Now, Brown had hopes of Supreme Court or presidency. Mock had hopes of this. Cranston was their boy, and they were willing to forestall temporarily this situation. But they didn't want anybody coming in from the outside of the machine and bumping this. So Mock and his bunch tried to keep Salinger out. Personally, there's not much choice. Bill, you got any more on this congressional business? You could tell us if you know more about it. Huh? You know more about this congressional, you said the congressman can be from...
Yeah, the Constitution describes the requirements for congressmen as well as senators. The Constitution may not be amended by any state law. The Constitution may only be amended by 3/4 of the state. No state cannot be amended.
Well, this is true, but now they in the state of California, what they...
I can go to Alabama tomorrow and file for Congress.
Well, they've never let this go through in California, though.
The only requirement is that you be a registered voter
in the district.
In the district that you are running.
Well, that's all right. Being a registered voter in the district is tantamount to residence in this state.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Well,
that's all right.
That's right.
But this
you have to be a registered voter, and that takes certain time.
Well, I mean, you have to
live in that county so long, and all the time, and the state so long, you become registered. When Dad came out here, he had to live here so long before they registered. He came here from New York to vote here in the ballot.
You can't vote here, and you can't register.
These laws are
so this is probably true,
but what they do is they run a
deal all their own way here and everywhere else until something comes up and stops it. But the Supreme Court would help Salinger, but it wouldn't help you and me.
Another question? You mean to get into the universe?
Yes.
Well, I know, all I know about it is in several articles. One was in the Scientific American, another was in one of the magazines, Harvard Astronomical Magazine, talking about what they thought might be the relation of this to certain polarity findings. They anticipate that they will be able to bore through the crust, but this, of course, is an extensive operation, and that the starting of this goes back to Admiral Perry. Now, Admiral Byrd knew, and believed and supported the fact of a hollow inner Earth, which many geologists support, and which, of course, is biblically supported, and that the density of metals between the outer and inner crust make up the bulk of Earth's weight, and that certain combinations of materials and metals and pressure produce the heat that we have in volcanic areas with internal pressures. That the pressures don't come from the center, the pressures work both ways. And they can establish this by the fact that temperatures are not the same over the Earth, not paying any attention to the frigid caps of the poles with their own surface cold. This has caused them to want to do much exploring in this area. For instance, you can go down to some mines and it's cold, it's cold at 67, 68 degrees. Other mines are very cold, and some mines at 2 miles depth are still cold, and other mines are so hot that it's almost impossible at such depth to stay. We have hot springs as well as we have volcanic action, some places right close to the surface, other places 5 miles in depth, so no heat at all. So there is no relationship to stability, such as they sought to say that the inner core temperatures were from molten centers, and as you came closer to the surface, the cold from outer air and the coldness of the crust cooled it down, got warmer as you went down. This is not true. We have discovered that some of the deepest drillings that we have today for deep oil show that there's no heat at all at the bottom. And so all of this has caused a whole new area of historical geology and exploratory geology. So this, how deep they'll be able to get this is only speculating, and core sizes are involved. We're just on the perimeter of this in areas of experimentation. These are preliminaries. They actually have hoped someday to drive the shaft to figure out as a subway tunnel and keep on going. But Byrd proved that this wasn't necessary. All we've got to do is keep on probing down at the South Pole, and they'll find the entrance because birds could get in and out of it. And in the midst of a condition of winter when it was cold and when there was nothing grows down there anyhow, birds could fly out with vegetation and could arrive with pieces of vegetation which they find on the ice. And they also found other things. They knew that there was an entrance to an area down there right in the midst of Antarctica where this could be. And of course, Byrd tells about several places where he saw buildings beneath the ice, old and ancient buildings beneath the ice, so the ice was clear. And this in one of the expeditions when they were traveling down there. Roy Palmer published some of this stuff of Byrd, where they were trying to suppress this. We have a bunch of runes in Washington today. Anything that they don't think they want the public to know, they decide you're not smart enough to understand. Only your super intellects are capable of this. So when they had unidentified flying objects and spacecraft, they said they didn't exist, even though they would spend millions of dollars to photograph them, say. And the same thing with the South Pole. They suppressed all of the Byrd information. After he died, they gathered up papers and took them out of circulation. They moved and transferred men all over that were attached to his staff. So, you see, there were Scandinavian scientists and explorers who discovered the entrance to a grass tunnel-like cavern that sloped in and moved in, and they talked about the changes of gravity there. They talk about the fact that there are shaft caverns that they think up somewhere between the California-Oregon border and up in this area, not too far from Eugene, Oregon. Somewhere in those hills, from ancient record tradition that they picked up, they think there's a possible entrance, and that because of this particular pattern of entrance, where it's located, that this affects the balance, the magnetic tables in this area, and this is why you have that area around that, that where everything is crazy. Levels don't operate right and so forth, but they think that there has been earthquake patterns that have closed off an entrance there, and there's talk about geological exploration there, but the government wants to do it, but they don't want to admit it. I guess they're afraid somebody will laugh at them, but I mean, people should be able to try anything. If you want to laugh, let them laugh. You know, they laughed at Noah, too. There's no explaining anything about the twists we have today, however, in the way governments think. I think you get so many Canaanites in there that they can't think straight anymore.
Do you ever hear Washington Vision?
Oh, yes. We published Washington Vision. Oh, there's not a doubt of it. I've seen the original.
Well, I have, too.
In Washington, in the Washington room in the Library of Congress.
That's right.
That's Scott McClellan.
The point is, a lot of people don't believe it, but... Now, what do you think about in that latter part of Washington's Vision, remember, after we had suffered and so forth, and we were practically equipped by the invasion army, remember the people got down and prayed, the women and children, he heard the cries of millions of women and children crying, didn't say he heard the men, I guess they were out in the army somewhere in the mountains, but anyway, remember they got down to pray, and then they looked up, and they saw heavenly beings coming in the sky.
Oh, so the reinforcements, that's right.
And that encouraged the American people.
They fought harder than ever.
Fought harder than ever, and they were able to drive them out of the
forest. That's right.
Now, those heavenly beings is what I'm coming to. And those heavenly beings that came through the air, do you think they could be flying saucers?
Well, all of this is coordinated. All of this is coordinated. And the first, what happens in a vision is after one has it, when they decide to write it up, and tell it. Detail sometimes isn't accurate. And McClellan wrote the detail, see, as Washington told it. And Washington had written it in two communications, see, as he remembered it. Now, in this, that's why you notice there was two versions. There was McClellan's published version and the letter. And they were slightly different because the other letter, what McClellan copied, that was there, that they had with it. So in this again, the invasion was the struggle against Negroes, the black, and the Asiatics carrying communism, and the flag and the horde symbolized as red, which is communism.
So they,
that's right.
It was the black. Well,
that's right.
And then it came the red.
Well, of course, this is all together. This is the Negro uprising, the anti-Christian communist Jew force with its Asiatic hordes. All this. Now, we've already got a fifth column internal invasion. We have the assault coming from the outside. Now, so these finally tie together, and with people like this, like Johnson, with his togetherness and so forth, they're just setting the stage for a sudden move, and it'll come. However, our biggest battle is not going to come, our big problems do not necessarily come from just turning the hordes that come against us from the outside. This we'd be more able to do easy. It's the thing on the inside that's so insidious.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you this, that when this battle is over, and during this battle, every commie and every commie financier and every kike anti-Christ will be utterly liquidated. There's not, and Negroes will be deported in masses if they're what's left.
See?
But inevitably, the thing will reach battling in the streets, see? Only the Lord utilizing the hosts of heaven to intervene will spare the masses of the elect. Because we're outnumbered 6-1. We have superior technology, but we don't have superior statesmanship. We don't play with the cunning of the enemy. We let the enemy come in and join us, see? I think that the areas... in this way, that anything that came in from outside, he classifies as a heavenly being.
Yeah.
Now, we, of course, have two words we use for heavenly beings. One is celestial, which means this is the spirit beings, and then there are embodied beings possessing spirit, and, of course, all the Adamic race and all the other races you see are bodily beings, but out in space, in the vastness of the universe, it's all under the organization from archangels and cherubs, seraphims, all kinds of orders. And if you go into the ancient writings of Enoch, you'll note that there were vast, that we have no way of computing in our finite limitations now, the vast extensive distances of the universe. But we do know that we now have a multiple of 10 times 126 trillion suns that are visible from Palomar, photographable. Or so we say, 126 trillion suns from Palomar, and 10 times this number at Harvard's electronic telescope. So this means that we have no way to compute miles over such areas. But from what Enoch saw, he was told that all these suns in their solar systems, of course, were part of the universe, were part of the, and that they were residents throughout all the universe, and that they were preached by the hosts of heaven. Yes, the whole universe is occupied everywhere. So even such orbs as the sun, and because there are beings that are resident, that are at home under temperatures that, because they're in a different dimension, and therefore the heat of this dimension from operation of exploding atoms and burning and consuming molecular masses don't affect something in a different vibratory plane. But the universe is made out of electricity and it's made out of light. So there are light planes that are not touched by the electronic planes of known substance. Now all electronic planes is what we call today the field of matter. So it's in this matter field that we get lots of the, the areas of rapid oxidation and all these patterns. So we don't have to worry about the areas of dimension. There are beings around us we can't see because they're in celestial planes and they stay in spirit form. But Enoch was told that, for instance, the great ships of Lucifer that were defeated by Michael the Archangel, they were just made out of substance and material, just like we make ships. And that he had on these craft not only rebellious angels that didn't keep their first estate but were in physical form, but he had gathered up people from various parts of the Milky Way, such as the Negroes, which he got to revolt with him. See, Negroes revolted under Lucifer and manned a lot of the ships. And they degenerated under Lucifer's mongrelization, mutation of divine law, for all transgression was a mutation of divine law. This is the reason why that Negroes, when Lucifer was defeated by Michael, and he was virtually imprisoned in the solar system, and eventually only the Earth and Saturn were the only spots he had. And now probably only the Earth, because Jesus said, "I saw Satan fall like a star out of heaven." Now that he's earthbound, and the Negroes that were defeated with him came in on those craft, are described in many sacred records as well as biblical record of this. Now, these Negroes, under Luciferian law, he mutated kind, introduced mongrelization, even bestiality. They dropped and degenerated. They're far beneath their once level. But at no time were they the level of the white man, because the white man embodied was the celestial family of the Most High God, spirit of his spirit and life of his life. These others were a creation, good in their place, but under rebellion, degenerated.
Yes.
See? So remember that in that struggle, that there were millions of ships involved. So you get an idea how big this thing was, see? But when you talk about 10 times 126 trillion suns, well, they weren't all even represented in the battle. Only one-third of the host of heaven were in this rebellion. Well, that's a pretty big area. But no general ever had as many men, and there wasn't as many men on Earth as he had under command and ships alone. So anyhow, in this strategy, we discover when Enoch was out at the celestial headquarters, he was in the Pleiades, at the Alcyone, and there, before he arrives, you'll note that he's on this huge floating island in space. And when he arrives in this vessel that he was taken in, this type of craft that Enoch was carried in the heavens in, he describes the fact that it was as though a great massive disk was in the sky, and it was land, and it had buildings on it. One building was so high that its top was in the clouds, and it was made out of as clear as crystal. It looked as though it were made unto him on diamonds and sapphires. But he said when he looked at this wall so sparkling, but you couldn't see through them because the light refraction was breaking out all the colors of the rainbow from it, say. And so you couldn't see through it, even though any part of it was transparent. And when he entered into its great halls, he said that high up and lifted up and suspended in the air in the great amphitheater, this huge palace was a throne. And one sat on the throne, and he said there were beings rising and even craft that ascended to it. He tells about this, but there were those round about that were ministering unto him that were winged. But he said that almost all of the angelic beings of heaven had no wings, and they were just like men, except a very few, and these winged ones that were just around the throne. See. Now, in this, again, It's a different picture than a lot of people have had. All angels they thought had wings, but they didn't. And these were a very special group. Then they were captains of hosts in upper echelon, and archangels commanded these hosts. See? And so it was that Lucifer had been and these archangels ruled a quarter of the universe. And Christ took over in his embodiment. He, the Eternal, takes over the quarter of the universe that Lucifer, by transgression, fell from. So there's the reason why, over in the book, that this is the mystery that you get in Peter, and that you find where it talks about him as being the father of all lights and all vibrations, which is no variables, no shadow of turning. Then it comes to, then in this, it talks about the fact that as far as it perceives, it talks about the day star rising in your hearts, and you perceive that now the day star is Christ. But the day star was Lucifer, son of the morning. The day star of this creation in this universe was, when they called this the day star, this was his title, he was Lucifer, son of the morning, which is the sun. And so as the sun is a symbol of light, he was the day star. Now the sun is the day star of every solar system, but the day star of this quarter of the universe, or the illumination ruler of light, was Lucifer, fallen. It had to be replaced, and so God himself assumes this quarter of the universe while carrying out the central control, until such days as he restores Lucifer in the ages to come. But never will he have ascendancy, as any archangel had no ascendancy over the race, which were the sons and daughters of God. So these ships came in great numbers. Now we know that Michael has a very special and unique army, and I don't know how much of it he has to use. Probably wouldn't have to use too much of it for what he's dissolved now. But the thing is that the book of Daniel tells us that Michael will fight for our race as he fought for the children of God in ancient times, and help us to defeat Lucifer and the powers of darkness. And he'll be driven from the earth, defeated and captured, just as he was driven out of the heavens. Now if you turn over to the Revelation, it tells us how Michael threw Lucifer out of the heavens to earth when they cleaned up space. Now Lucifer is going to be defeated here. He's got no place to go. So they're going to gather him out. They're going to gather out his host and defeat them and imprison him within the nether chambers for that 1,000 years of measure. Yes.
Well, you know, Michael was just good by the Prince of Persia.
Well, that's right. But then you see, when Michael was withstood, remember that Michael had come with a message. And he embodied himself and came to talk to Daniel. And when he came through our stratosphere and he got into Lucifer's bailiwick, he didn't have any experience down here by himself in a physical embodiment with these hosts. And he had to use all of the lore that he had to withstand, and still withheld, until they sent another angel, Gabriel, I believe, came to his assistance and released him so that he could finish his task. But as far as being a logistical master at the use of vast fleets of spacecraft, why, at this Ezekiel or at this Michael's a fast master. See? But out of his area, why, this might have been something else. See?
I mean,
that's why it would be like taking a tank commander and putting him in charge of a few infantry. He might know how to do that. Oh, my, no. No.
No,
no. What, niggers? Oh, Negroes Lucifer didn't begat Negroes. Lucifer mongrelized with his fallen angels with various races and produced black and white and brown and tan Jews. Jews are the offspring of Lucifer, but not Negroes. Negroes are people he mutated with, just like they mutated with the white race with the seduction of Eve and produced Cain. Well, Lucifer and his fallen angels are the father of all Jews. Jesus proved this. He says, I am of God. And he said to the Jews, and ye are of the devil. I am of my father, you and your father. He said, ye are the father of the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He says, and your father was a murderer in the beginning, and he identifies them with Cain. And then comes over in the book of Matthew, after saying this in John, he comes over to the book of Matthew and said, you're guilty of the blood of all the righteous that have been slain on the earth, from Abel to Zacharias, killed between the horns of the altar. So that specific bunch of Jews he was talking about had to be Canaanites, or they wouldn't have been guilty of the blood of Abel.
Cain is when
Adam and Eve were placed in the earth. Remember that God had planted a garden eastward of Eden, He says all of the herbs, all of the trees that and herbs that are for fruit, meat you can eat. See, there's only one thing that you cannot eat of, and this is the tree of knowledge of good and of evil. This is a racial tree. This is the tree of Lucifer and his rebellious hosts, and of all the races on earth that now know good and evil. To have a knowledge of good and evil requires intellect, and it's not a fruit tree. It's not a tree for herbs and for fruit. This is a tree which is the physical race tree, the family tree. That's right. Now, so Lucifer seduced Eve. The serpent was not a snake. The serpent was the title of Lucifer. He was, the Dragoonus was his emblem, and the dragon and the serpent, Hydra. Oh, well, he was a man. Now, the serpent, his symbol is cursed, too. But then Lucifer himself, his empire was like the ancient empire in China. For instance, the dragon, and over in India, the serpent. Well, 11,000 years ago, they were using this emblem. And 240,000 years ago, the Sumerians recorded the emblem. And 73,000 years ago, when the Negroes were coming into Sumerian land in the rebellion pattern, well, they carried the serpent emblem again, the snake. See, now, so you see, this goes way back there as an emblem, but our race only been here 7,400 years. So now, the thing I want to point out is, now, so this is the tree of knowledge of good and evil, was the race tree of the Luciferian host. Now, Lucifer seduced Eve, and so he tempted her, and she did eat. And then did God say that if ye move into this association, you'll die? This is not so, see? Now, Adam and Eve were enveloped in radiant light. They were dwelling in the paradise of the inner earth. They could come out upon it as long as they were clothed with light. But the moment that they lost this aura, because this celestial body could not cohabit with evil, so they lost their aura. Now death was on them. Without this balance of this energy of light, there was nothing to keep the body balanced from rapid oxidation. There was nothing that would protect the cells from violations of law. Because ages before this, Lucifer had crossed animalcula and protozoa and bacteria and produced germs. And you see, the body was protected by the aura of light, but it wasn't after this. So death, the moment you violate this law, lose your light, you die. So they didn't die in that 24 hours, but death was on them. They had no immunization against this. It eventually would get to them, and it did. Now the fact is that, for instance, today we're making germs and viruses that are new in our chemical laboratories that we're not able to resist because we have no body resistance to them, and so is the Russians. This is what we call germ warfare. In fact, so how do we do it? We cross existing animalcula. We get these animalcula and we breed these bacteria and viruses and cultures and then mix the cultures. And after a while, if we mix a lot of them and they have, and such pseudopodia, for instance, they can crossbreed. So what do we come up with? We come up now in these lower forms, we come up with the fact that they're not governed by chromatin. They don't have any chromatin inside of genes as you do in mitosis. And so therefore, we get multiple mutations, and out of these multiple mutations, we get germs. Well, now all these factors were real, and so Lilith was the female consort of Lucifer after his fall. Lilith, L-I-L-T-H, Lilith. You go get it. She was a female fallen angel. In other words, after they fell in deep the first estate, Lilith. Therefore, you go to any Encyclopedia Britannica or anything, if you have Lilith, you will find that she was the consort of Lucifer. Now Lilith. So therefore, Lilith. After the seduction of Eve, then Lilith seduces Adam. In other words, Adam. That's right, Adam and the offspring. Now wait a moment. Now, this is the pattern. Eve bears Cain, but there's a whole posterity of Adam through Lilith that make up peoples that dwell in India, who are the children of the Ganges, the mother Ganges, the serpent Kali. His Lilith, Isis, Ishtar, it's all one and the same, coming down through the years.
Well, now, wait a minute, you're a little loose with that. I'm going to take this slow here. Yes, you know. If you pardon me, but anyway, now let me get this straight. Lucifer
had a wife.
He had a wife.
That's right, well named.
Who was it, Eve or?
No, Lilith.
Well, I've heard people say that Lucifer seduced Eve.
Yes, he did.
And,
he absolutely did.
Had intercourse with Eve.
No, yes. Just a moment here.
Let's
get back. Wait, hold still. Let's talk about it now. Lilith is the wife of Lucifer. But Lucifer Lucifer seduced Eve. I mean, he'd have taken any set of prostitutes he could find. But he took Eve, the wife of Adam.
Yeah.
And Cain's offspring.
And Cain then, and so the father of Cain is Lucifer.
That's right. Now, but
and the mother of Cain is Eve.
That's right.
That's why you
Adam partook of the same transgression.
Well, he went to the Lucifer.
The Lil. That's right.
We've got
a long genealogy of this and all the evidence of it.
Well, Adam took Lil.
That's right.
He left Eve.
No, he didn't leave Eve. It was just the orgy.
Well, then what came of her? Of that together?
All right. A lot of those people are in India today, and they know their origin. And it's a part of their history.
They came from that.
That's right. Not all of them, just some of them. Some of the peoples of India will, and they tell you in their own Hindu religion that they descended from Adam and the mother of the Ganges, Kali, the serpent woman.
How do you spell that?
L-I-L-T-H.
L-I-L-T-H. Well, this is really good.
It was pretty bad.
Well, where did Lilf come from? That's what I
want to know. Well, Lilf came out of the space at the time of the fall, and the fallen angels. But you see,
fallen
angels. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I guess she did.
Now, remember,
she and Adam.
That's right.
And they brought forth the Indians. See,
and remember, and the Adam says, and the woman did tempt me, and I also did eat.
Oh yeah.
Now this idea, which comes out of the Catholic Church, but they didn't start it. The Jews messed it up and created this doctrine that when Adam knew Eve, that this was a part of the original transgression, and thus we are born in sin. This is not true. This comes out of ignorance. In other words, there was nothing wrong at any time with Adam taking Eve and producing progeny. No, at any time. And there were many children of Adam and Eve. Now, there is no transgression associated at any time with the propagation of the Adamic race. And so therefore no process of the function of reproduction was a transgression. None of it was under curse. All of this is a twist. Now, the violation of law, Adam did not partake of Eve's transgression when he knew Eve. He partook of Eve's transgression when he knew Lilith. Now the fact remains that at no time did Adam or Eve violate the law that they had been originally given concerning the other races. They never mixed with Negroes. They didn't mix with the Taurogs that were over all the earth. See? And Lucifer came in with all the splendor and glory, majesty, pomp, power, and seduced Eve.
Well, then the trouble came actually through Lucifer and Eve.
That's right. That's right.
That's where the sin came.
And Adam participated in it. See? Adam participated in it. Well, when he took Lilith. You can't go around mixing with fallen angels and get away with it. In other words,
who was his,
Will.
Who came, who was the children from Adam?
Well, those children were never permitted to develop in the society of Adam and Eve because Will never stayed any more than Lucifer. They got out of the garden before God got back.
Yeah, they got away.
Yeah. And they went in India. India today is traces their Kali Hindu posterity back to Adam and Lilith, and they call Lilith the mother of the Ganges. But over in the fallen angels that hadn't kept their first estate, that remained from Tidal, king of the nations, in that area, do you remember what they referred to the fact that they came from Isis and Ishtar. Now Ishtar, the goddess Ish, and Ishtar is a part of this. And this, see, in other words, there's various names all over the world for Lilith. Isis, Ishtar, Madame Blavatsky. She's just another incarnation of the same devil.
Well, listen, where did Seth come from then?
Seth, all right, now the scripture says... Abel was the son of Adam, but remember this.
Eve
was his mother.
Now,
I'll show you something. Even though he was more righteous, he was never an acceptable person for the seed of the kingdom. Because after an adulterous relation, which has to relate to another race or another species,
mm-hmm.
the womb is not cleansed until 7 gestations take place. So therefore, none of the offspring of Adam and Eve until the 7th gestation was acceptable to produce the purity of the white race. And that's why when Seth was born, Adam, this is why nothing is said until Seth is born in Scripture. And then Adam says, I have now begotten a man in my own image after my own likeness.
There's so Seth was the 7th gestation?
That's right. And he was, and the Scripture tells you that. Now, therefore this makes,
well,
this purifies the line.
Abel was the 7th gestation.
No.
Well, now where was Abel? How about Abel?
Abel's dead.
Yeah, I know.
All right, now he's the second.
Somewhere.
Yeah, all right, so he's the 2nd gestation.
No, he wasn't the second. Wasn't he the first? Because he came from Eve, didn't he?
That's right, but Eve had already born one child. In other words, the contamination wasn't on Adam, it was on Eve.
Well, what child did she born? She born Cain.
She born Cain.
Oh, yeah, and then she bore...
Then she bore Abel.
Then
she bore
Abel.
And then she bore a whole string of them, and then Seth. That's right. The Scripture...
That's the 7th.
The 7th. And the Scripture tells you, in the Scripture, you'll discover...
And you got proof of that.
Oh, yes. Sure, I got proof of it. The Bible tells you how many Seth was. That's right, the Scripture tells you.
Now
it tells you this, yes, and then it goes on and tells you in the law that it takes 7 gestations for the cleansing of the womb. Now, you have more than this involved in it, because we have other books like the Book of Seth, see? The Book of Adam and Eve, the Book of Seth, and the Book of the Bee. And so the names of the other children of Adam and Eve are given. But most of them were destroyed by the struggles between the, at a later time, well, they grew up and they had families and were growing, and then they were wiped out by Canaanites and by Asiatics and so forth, see?
Okay.
So this was maybe a mercy because you see, they could not produce a unmutated seed line.
Yeah.
But
she
could. That's right.
And from Seth on, now you have a pure, so that's the beginning of the pure white
race. Pure white race.
Good.
And so... So this, now to prove this to you, the Messiah who was going to redeem the race, so God himself was going to redeem the race, and was going to emerge out of the race, not ashamed to call us his kinsmen, because he foreknew all this before the foundation of the world anyhow, and thought it was worth the experiment. Now, in this, it traces the genealogy of Jesus back to Seth, who was the son of Adam, who was the son of God. See? So therefore it proves this is the pure seed line, and you see it text right down through there, and makes the jump. That's Adam.
Oh, this is wonderful. That now is getting straightened out, finally. I never planned to do that.
What'd you say? The nature of manna? Well, I never synthesized it, but they did that in the laboratories of heaven. And I don't know what they composed it out of, but it was a pretty powerful vitamin tablet. Well, it may taste like honey. There are several things. There are several things that every once in a while fall from the sky now that have a honey-like flavor, but the thing was that manna had solidified like a wafer, because it could pick it up. See, I hate to pick up honey, you know, but manna fell to the ground like a wafer, almost like a wafer of snow, see. Well, there wasn't any doubt about its miraculous delivery, see. I don't doubt that they flew over a great big craft and shoveled it out, see? I mean, this is very possible. If they could have dropped it in sacks, but that had been too easy and they would be in place, they wouldn't have to pick it up.
And you've got a book that'll tell me where I can read about Lil?
Oh, yes, I got some books with Lil. They're all about it. That's right.
That's what I want to find out.
Okay. Okay. I can't tell you just which orb out there she came from.
No, she actually existed.
Oh, yes, she did. She is, I don't think she's been missing at any time, you know. She's been coming and going like Lucifer. I can't prove it, but she could have been a relative of Eleanor's. Do I think she's white? I think that she was probably so. I don't think that she lacked anything for beauty, see. Because Lucifer filled the sum full of beauty, cunning, and intelligence, see.
Oh,
first place, white men at that time were superior to everything in the earth, and they wouldn't have anything to do with Negroes or Asiatics or anybody else, and they wouldn't take a second look at Lucifer, no matter how fast he talked, if he hadn't looked white and Lilith hadn't looked white. Besides, white is the color of the masters of the universe. Remember this. Remember when eventually all things are put under the feet of Christ, it's a great white throne. See? And when you see the company that of hosts, it's a great
all
white company, see?
Absolutely.
And they come in white robes, just like
white
the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, let me ask you this. How did these colored races all get in here then?
The Asiatic race was the Taurogs were the first creation, or should we say the remaining creation of the sixth day. When God had made man and woman, and said they multiply and replace the earth, but this is the way Adam and Eve came forth. He brought forth Adam and Eve, Adam as his issue, and took Eve out of Adam, so they might be one flesh. But he did this on the seventh day.